Hi there, my name's Ollie Lloyd and welcome to the Food Talk Show. On today's show, I'm delighted to be joined by Orlando Murren. Now, Orlando was a semi-finalist on MasterChef in the 90s and was then the editor of BBC Good Food for 6 years. He founded Olive magazine and then switched track to become a chef hotelier in the southwest of France and then Somerset. He's written 7 cookbooks and is the president of the Guild of Food Writers and has now written a crime novel called Knife Skills for Beginners. So let me start by welcoming Orlando to the Food Talk Show and saying a big thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Ollie. Thank you. It's great to be here.
So, I mean, this is quite a career in the world of food. I mean, how did it all start? How did you get into the world of food? And I suppose the beginning, which was, I suppose, MasterChef.
I fell into it by accident. I was a magazine journalist on lifestyle magazines. I started off, I had a lucky break and I got a job at Radio Times, BBC Radio Times, because I was a classical musician, so I could spell composers' names. And at that time, I could also remember opus numbers. Unfortunately, a knack which I have lost as I've got older, I can't remember opus numbers anymore. However, I got a job. Then I carried on in magazines, and it suited me very well because I liked the people, I didn't mind the very hard work, and I enjoyed grammar and editing. So I was a sub-editor, and then I became an editor, and then and all the things in between. My best jobs were as assistant editor of Country Homes and Interiors, when I went around the country interviewing rich, famous people, which was great fun. And second best was deputy editor of Cosmopolitan, when I learned a lot about female sexuality, which is, I'd like to say, stood me in good stead. But I found it interesting.
I did a stint at Hearst magazines, and where Cosmo is now, lives. And I have to say, you know, the conversation on the office floor was very different to previous jobs I've had.
I also was the first male editor of Woman and Home magazine. Anyway, at that point, this is what I was doing. I was having a great time, and some bright spark, I was throwing a Sunday lunch, said, you need to enter this new, as it then was, TV cookery competition called MasterChef. I said, never heard of it, I said. Never managed to watch it. In those days, this was 1992, you couldn't just watch things. I'd missed it. So I entered and I adored it. And the days of Lloyd Grossman, I got so excited and I won the quarterfinal, got through the semi-final, and to my enormous rage and disappointment, got knocked out of the semi-final. I didn't want to win the whole competition, but I wanted to have cook my third menu, which was a lovely menu. And after that, people thought, the guy can cook. And I started to get kind of food work, and I was asked to write a daily column for the Express newspaper. And then the editorship of BBC Good Food came up, and they said, there's, you know, a magazine editor who's actually got a bit of cooking in him. So I got that job, and it was the most fabulous job. I caught it at the marvellous moment. The magazine did so well. Every year it outsold the previous year, and I had an absolutely marvellous career there, at the end of which we launched Olive. And I felt that really I did 6 years, 6 Christmases. Each Christmas on a food magazine, you're making it more gloriously traditional than the year before. And there is a limit. And I think also I feel you want to let someone else have a go. So I did make the decision to do something that I'd always wanted to do, which was own a restaurant hotel. So I went off to France to do that. And it was the most exciting thing. Everyone was very excited on my behalf, and it was a huge success. Hundreds of people came and stayed with us, and we survived 6 years of that with my then partner. I say survived because behind the scenes it was actually very, very difficult life, but the customers had a marvellous time, and the customers were lovely. We never had a problem with a customer. The problem I had was with logistics. You know, we were 40 minutes from a shop in darkest, deepest France, where the electricity or the water could go off at any moment. And so it was heaven for our guests, but hell for the people trying to give them a good stay. So I won't dwell on it, but that was a very tough time for me. And then we came back to Somerset and madly did it again. And that was much better, much easier, because we weren't so remote. And in fact, running business in England, in Britain, seemed much easier than running one in France. I survived that. But I did say that after 3 years of that, when we sold that, I said, I've done entertaining for the rest of my life. And so I split up with my then partner, which is probably, you know, part of the story, really. But I said, I'm never again having a dining room or a guest bedroom. And I live in Bliss in Exeter with no dining room and no guest bedroom. And I don't entertain. I've done it. I've done it in our last year. We had 900 people to dinner. So I kind of think I've done entertaining. And that makes me sound really antisocial. I still love people and I love eating out, but I don't entertain at home.
I think after that journey, that is understandable. So look, let me take you back, because I'm intrigued by something. Tell me about the genesis of Olive, because obviously I know BBC Good Food very well. Obviously, you know, it's a magazine I've subscribed to over the years, and obviously everyone uses. Tell me why was Olive created back then? Because it always has a slightly different feel to BBC Good Food, and still does.
Well, that's a really, really interesting question, Ollie, and I'm delighted to have been asked it. I'm not sure that anyone has ever asked it before, so I'm going to answer it quite carefully, because it's ever so slightly kind of delicate in a way. What happened was that Good Food was doing so very well in the centre of the market that one lunchtime, about 3 or 4 years in, one lunchtime, we thought, oh, let's pop out Easy Cook. Let's do one for people who are less good at cooking and less interested, which was mainly reuse of the easier recipes from Good Food. It did terribly well. It took someone 10 minutes a month to make. That's, of course, an extreme exaggeration. It was very well done, but it was just very straightforward and people loved it and it found its mark. So then we thought, well, we should try and occupy the more deluxe end of the cookery market so that we occupy the whole market, which has advantages for advertising because they've got a complete portfolio and people might want to advertise in two magazines as well as in one. And so this is the kind of delicate bit. At that point, there was a magazine that no one knew doing very well in Australia, a beautiful magazine called Delicious. And we thought that it would be wonderful to bring a British edition of Delicious into the BBC Good Food stable. And we pitched for it. And we pitched for it very seriously, but we didn't get it. It was given to a different publishing house. And I was profoundly hurt and upset by this, feeling that it was a personal wound to my vanity that they didn't want great Orlando Murren Enterprises editing and publishing this gorgeous magazine. So we said, well, we'll do it anyway. And so Olive was born to fill the gap, to make sure that we had the three parts, what we perceived as the three parts of the market. So Olive wasn't based on Delicious at that point. We knew Delicious well, but Delicious as it came out, which will have been in 2003-04, I think, had quite a lot of overlap with BBC Good Food. And Olive didn't have a lot of... Olive was a very distinct product deliberately from BBC Good Food. More restaurant-y, more let's go out and eat, more let's copy restaurant food, more quick and tricksy and smooth and trendy and all the rest of it. And so that's what Olive has always been. And I think it had three thrusts. It had eat out, eat in and eat away, I think was the original tagline. So it had a lot of travel in it and a lot of restaurants in it and glammy quick fix recipes in it. It's changed a lot since then. I think it's a wonderful product. I love that magazine.
Well, look, I think there are only about three or four of us in the UK who have actually founded, you know, big food platforms. You know, I founded Great British Chefs, which in many ways was the next step on from Olive, which is to say, yes, that's got that part of the market as Delicious do, but we're going to go next level and work directly with, you know, the great chefs of Britain to create, you know, the even more complicated recipes. So in some ways, I suppose we've all collectively kind of followed the journey of Britain's culinary evolution from that much more basic stuff in the sort of 70s, 80s and 90s into then that more early stage restaurant stuff in Delicious and Olive, and then ultimately probably into Great British Chefs, which was then, you know, 2010-11. I didn't know that history of Olive. That's very interesting to hear.
Yeah, and I mean, as it turned out, we loved having Delicious in the market with us. It did a lot of good for the profession. It's more work, it's more jobs, it's more talent floating around. And it was a lovely magazine. And it had that most wonderful editor, Karen Barnes, for years. I hope you've had Karen Barnes on the show. She's a wonderful editor.
I know Karen. She's recently stepped out, hasn't she? So I mean, I'm interested when you look back, because obviously you've been in the food industry for many years. How do you think food has changed in the UK? Because it's interesting, because on some level, I was talking to Charlie Bingham the other day, who was saying that actually it's actually changed a lot less than people think when you look outside of London. You know, in London, clearly is a very particular kind of culinary melting pot. You live in Exeter, you know, obviously the food scene, you know, the Southwest has obviously developed hugely over the last few years. But how do you feel the food world has changed in the last sort of 20 years?
And well, it's interesting that Charlie Bigham should say that. And Exeter's, you know, it's quite off the beaten track. So we don't have a very wide choice of restaurants. Restaurants in London, I'm amazed at how many people are out in bars and restaurants. It looks to me as if people don't cook at home at all because they're all swarming around the restaurants at the moment. Here, we haven't got that choice. So we either cook our own food. We can get primitive kind of takeaways as well. And there are a couple of good restaurants, but it's not a restaurant scene at all. The supermarkets, meanwhile, are astounding what they've got in them, and the ranges have continued to increase more and more widely. I would have thought 20 years ago that we were at peak with supermarkets, that, you know, there was nothing more to discover around the world to bring into the supermarkets. Now, how wrong I was. The stuff continues to come along, new stuff. Occasionally products drop out because they're no longer wanted, but still new stuff gets created. And then there are all the labour-saving products now, of which Charlie Bigham is a marvellous example of a way that you can eat really well without actually doing all the work yourself. And they're very interesting.
I suppose Charlie's point in some ways is, because you're right, I think the supermarkets have done an enormous amount, but I suppose one of his views and your comment about how you had to reinvent BBC Good Food Christmas offering every year, and I'm always amused by how one has to kind of do that as a magazine editor. I suppose in some ways, some of the dishes that were our favourites 20 years ago are still our favourites, whether that's a fish pie, whether that's spaghetti bolognese, whether that's a roast chicken. You know, obviously there are new things in the more veg-first area, but it's interesting how much it's changed.
You say that. I think that the basic flavour profile that people are looking for has changed in the past 20 years. It was starting to change then, and it's changed. It's much spicier now than it was, much more chilly, much more different cuisines from Asia. When I left Good Food, we were starting to get the special diet. The special diets were starting to get popular. And when I went to France to cook, I found to my great surprise that was really burgeoning every month or so. Someone was coming out with some new dietary requirement that I hadn't thought existed. But that rolling Boulder has continued, so that now the free from departments are burgeoning, and whether it's meat you don't want to eat or flour or wheat or nuts or anything else, that has really expanded. So that's a whole kind of zone in the supermarket, and people wanting to eat less meat is another, less meat and fish.
So obviously, you were very, I'd say, grounded in the UK food scene, right? And then you go to France. Tell me, I mean, you know, there's obviously always the debate between French food and you know, what's happening in France versus what's happening in Britain. I mean, tell me about that experience of cook, you know, an Englishman, you know, cooking in France and running a hotel in France. What was that like?
Oh, it was the most extraordinary culture shock, but quite wonderful. We happened to buy a house in a French hamlet with about 12 people living in it. And they embraced us like their dear family. They were unbelievably welcoming and helpful. They fed us, they gave us plants and trees and chickens, and they could not have been kinder or more welcoming and fun and warm. When I got back to England a few years later, I was struck how chilly the people seemed compared with this French hamlet. Now, it might just have been luck, but they were amazing. And so I had to learn to cook quite very quickly with French ingredients. But French ingredients, of course, are lovely, and the markets, it's all there for you to find. But the real difference for me was that I was suddenly a restaurateur, a chef, where I had to, you know, get everything ordered, devise menus and make sure that I had everything, because if I didn't have everything, you know, if someone went hungry, we were too far from anywhere to get food which we hadn't ordered in advance. So that's where the logistical problem came in. But the actual cooking was enormous fun, and I cooked almost entirely French food, but almost all our guests were British or North American or non-French. So I didn't cook very often for French people, although when I did, they were delighted and surprised, I think. I made this fabulous dessert, which was a very, very complicated piece of cooking. When there's sort of nutty meringue things layered up with gorgeous kind of custardy thing. It was very, very gorgeous. I made a great big one for the villagers one time, and they ate this, and they really enjoyed it when they came to eat with us. And as I say, they were delightfully surprised. And they said, oh, compliments to your pâtissier, because they thought I'd bought this creation. And of course, I was very flattered that they should think that I'd used a pâtissier, whereas in fact, I just made it from myself from scratch. But the guest feedback was quite marvellous. You know, people loved coming to stay with us, and the guests were charming and warm and adorable. And we have lots of very good friends from that period that I met, purely because they were customers.
It's interesting, isn't it? My brother's married to a French lady, and when she comes, when her mother comes for Christmas, I remember once serving her a Jerusalem artichoke dauphinoise, and her being completely confused that, you know, anyone would ever think of doing a dauphinoise with anything but potatoes.
That's a very, they dislike tinkering with dishes. They say you can make that if you like, but it isn't gratin dauphinois. I'm sorry, Ollie, but not gratin dauphinois. Don't call it gratin dauphinois. And in fact, I wrote a cookbook from recipes from that period, and I called it accidentally pomme dauphinois in the book. And we had this fantastic housekeeper called Monique, who was the most glorious person you could ever work with. And she said, and she genuinely said, what, qu'est-ce que c'est, pomme dauphinois? And she said she'd never heard of it. Of course, it's known as gratin dauphinois, so pomme dauphinois. They're very, very literal in their cooking, and they're quite right to be, because these things mean something. They've got a tradition, and you don't just fool about with them. If you fool about with them, you give them a new name, or you make a name up. You don't pass them off.
And is that not, I suppose, one of the great benefits of the food scene in the UK is, on one level, we are more iconoclastic with our approaches to food, and are more relaxed about smashing things together and fusing together different cuisines and different cultures and different ingredients in ways that we hadn't imagined.
And the French are taught at school that British cooking is risible. They are actually taught that. And, you know, if it's gone in at a sufficient early age, there's nothing you can do about it. We had young waiting staff who came to us and they were baffled at the deliciousness of the meal that I gave them as part of their wages, as it were, because they couldn't believe they'd heard that British food was disgusting. Truly, actually disgusting. And so you can't do anything about that. And worse than that, they were taught that French cooking was the only cuisine in the world. Now, French cuisine is one of the great cuisines of the world, but there are others, actually, are there not? I mean, Italian, for instance, maybe Moroccan, maybe Chinese, maybe Japanese. There are quite a few if we start hunting around, aren't there?
Definitely, definitely. And it's one of those... It was always, I think, you know, my parents certainly spent their summers, you know, driving around France in their Renault 5, you know, touring different restaurants and things. And there was always the sort of debate with my father, who was an American, about, you know, what was, you know, was it all about French cooking or were there other cuisines that were as interesting? And I think over time, you know, I think he realised actually that the sheer breadth of what was available and I think the excitement of some of the other great, you know, culinary traditions, I think, which increasingly, I think, you know, I'm not sure how relevant French cuisine is today in places like London. I think it's sort of taken a bit of a backseat versus other cuisines.
Long may they continue to do it in their own country, though. I mean, their fierce ring-fencing of their national culture, although we may chuckle over it and say those provincial French, you know, ignoring what's happening in the rest of the world. I mean, it's rather wonderful to have a living museum there of wonderful food, wonderful buildings, wonderful countryside, and wonderful language. I mean, there's so much that's marvellous about France.
Oh, indeed. For me, the great joy, the baguette in the morning, remains one of the great pleasures of life in France.
And they're so lovable in their pride, their pride in France and French things. And so I always felt a bit mean kind of saying, well, there are other, you know, there are other countries. And they have problems. Obviously, I'm generalising, but when they go travelling, they tend to travel rather nervously in packs, only speaking French to one another and eating the food rather nervously. They like to retain their French identity even when they go abroad. But no, I love them for it.
So let's jump from the joys of French cooking to the world of crime novels. I mean, well, Anna, we got you on the show because you'd obviously you know, joined or you produced this this new book. Tell us about it and where it kind of came from.
Well, thank you for asking me. I mean, it's lovely to be asked about it because it's quite unusual to be producing your debut novel in your 60s. And in fact, that the reason that I finally got round to it was because I thought, now or never. I'd always liked the idea. I like murder mysteries. I like reading them. My grandfather was a famous spy catcher and a detective and an interrogator, and he used to regale us with stories of murder and mayhem when I was a child. So I've always enjoyed it. And then about 20 years ago, I went on a wonderful crime writing course at the Arvon Foundation, which is a really a magazine editor, a friend of mine said, who'd written a novel, said, oh, try the Arvon Foundation to get yourself started. And I did a course there and wrote a few chapters. And then I, over the years, I had another go. But about 3 years ago, I thought, I can't fool myself any longer that this is something I'm going to do when I've got time. I'm actually going to do it. And I actually said to myself, this time, I am in deadly earnest. Could have called the book that, In Deadly Earnest, couldn't I? And so I did it, and I threw my entire skill set at it and really, really worked at it and sent it off and very happily found an agent for it and a fantastic publisher. And I I didn't realise that it was quite such a new career, because I'd always written journalism and recipes all my life and columns for magazines and things. I didn't realise that it was so different from that. And I didn't realise that the industry was such a large and vibrant industry with so many levels. It makes actually cookbooks look, with no disrespect whatsoever to cookbooks, it makes it look a little bit of a backwater, because there's so much fiction sold that they have big publicity machines, big marketing machines. The whole thing feels bigger. And then I started going to the crime festivals. They're not festivals for criminals, they're crime writing festivals. And I met a whole new gang. And I love food writers. I've always thought that food writers were the best. When I worked in general interest magazines, the people that you wanted to hang out with were the features editors for a bit of goss, and the food people because you got nice things to eat and drink and they were a good laugh. So I found the food writers were very jolly. You always get very well looked after, but they're very warm and friendly, I find. So then I put all that behind me. Well, I haven't exactly. I still hope that they will read my fiction, because it is, after all, culinary crime that I've written. The crime people are really, really lively. And I pause before lively. They're quite heavy drinking, I'll say that. The food isn't as good as the food people. The level of snacks isn't as good. And there's a kind of element of going off to get something to eat because they're hungry, which has never been my attitude about food. You go off to get something to eat because there's a possibility of finding something delicious to enjoy. So hunger doesn't cut. Even if I am hungry, it's not why I go to eat. It's just to eat something marvellous. So I'm a bit choosy. They probably think I'm a bit stuck up on the old food front, but they're very funny and they're very bright and they like a good joke.
So give us, without giving any spoilers away, give us the sort of brief idea of the book that you've written.
It's called Knife Skills for Beginners. It's a story about a chef food writer, and it's not particularly me, although I'm sure I share aspects with him, called Paul, who is called in at short notice to teach a cookery course at a posh but shabby round the edges London cookery school. So the cookery school is in Chester Square in Belgravia, one of those great white stucco buildings. And Paul, who was recently bereaved about 14 months ago, his partner of 10 years died, and left him a tiny house round the corner in Belgravia, which he can't really afford to run. So he says, okay, he finds the whole thing a bit of a challenge going out, because he's been a bit introspective, recovering really. But as it's down the road, his best friend, who's a very wacky magazine journalist called Julie, says, oh, come on, Paul, pull yourself together. You know, it'll be good for you. Get you out of the house and earn a few pounds. So he says he'll do it. And he goes around rather trepidatiously to the school. And it's very creepy. The school is creepy. But it's got a beautiful cookery school, which is a modern conversion of an old ballroom. And then the students arrive, 8 students bounce in. And I've been to quite a few cookery courses in my life, either teaching them or as a kind of spectator. And people do get a bit odd on cookery courses. They start to behave a bit oddly. Some of them are competitive. Some of them are no good. Some of them have got that thing called sticky hand syndrome, where everything they touch turns to glue. And the mechanics, the social mechanics of it are very interesting. People turn into exaggerated versions of themselves in that context. So something very bad happens on the first night, and the students should all be sent home. But the proprietor of the school, who's a weird woman called Rose, is too mean to offer refunds. And the police have asked people to stick around for a couple of days. So she says, well, continue teaching the course. I'm not giving refunds. And the students agree. So this poor guy, Paul, is left while a horrible crime investigation goes on, teaching this cookery course. And so what he starts to do is, when he realises that he's under suspicion for the crime, he starts to watch them very carefully. So while he's teaching them, like, kneading pastry and indeed knife skills, he's watching watching for clues as to who might have done it. Interwoven with the story are six killer recipes, my best recipes. They combine to form an actually delicious dinner party menu. They've been double tested by my wonderful food director from my good food days, in a woman called Angela Nilsson. So they really do work. But they, if you read them carefully, you might find that they steer you towards the ending of, and give you a few clues along the way.
And are the recipes sort of spaced out across the book? You kind of come across them as you go through them?
Yeah, there are six recipes. There's one at the beginning, and then they're spaced out in a logical way. But if you make them in order, they do form a delicious meal. And the first one, which is Parmesan Bites, is being served at my launch party. I've made 165 Parmesan Bites to give to my guests.
Excellent. I love it. I love it. Well, I'm not sure. Is there another crime novel? I mean, you may know this because you're now, hanging out with crime novel writers rather than criminals. Has there ever been a crime novel written with recipes within it?
In the United States, it's not unheard of. There's a kind of genre, a very cozy crime is what it's called if you have a non-violent, non-police procedural crime book. And there are quite a lot of cupcake, coffee shop, cat kind of... I don't mean to sound disparaging. They're excellent and they're very popular, but they often have recipes interwoven. But the recipes tend to be recreational rather than actually part of the story. In this, they are part of the story, and as I say, they provide clues. And the food is very integral to the story because Paul is very much a chef and he goes about trying to solve the crime with a cook's eyes of, dismantling and looking at ingredients and methods and techniques. He's a technician, and so he uses the food as a way to solve the crime, which he ends up doing.
Amazing. Well, I have to say, I am very much looking forward to reading it. And I suppose I'll have to pick one of the six recipes to try cooking after all that. So do you feel that is this the beginning of something new? Do you feel like, having been through the process of writing a crime novel, that you want to continue on this?
In a year's time, there's a sequel coming out, I'm very glad to announce. And I've got ideas for two more, with the same guy, with Paul, this rather lovable chef guy.
He's not going to France, is he? He's not moving to France, is he?
Might do. I'm not saying. Actually, the second one is almost finished now. But I absolutely love it. And even half an hour before we started speaking, Ollie, I was sending an email to someone and I said, I think this is actually my last career because it's just so engrossing and such fun, and I can see myself going on doing it. I mean, never say never. Maybe I've got another career after that. But it seems to me to bring together everything that I've been doing during my life. The food, the writing, the observation of people, the sense of humour, and an interest in mystery and telling people stories. So it seems to me that this is bringing everything together, everything that I've done.
I think the only potential evolution is you can bring it all together and start doing weekends where you invite people away for a weekend where the story unfolds, you serve food, and there is a murder to solve. It's the sort of the secret cinema equivalent where you have the sort of fusion of the worlds.
Yeah, no, that's a very interesting idea. A kind of live event, really.
Exactly. There's some quite large castles down near you in Exeter. I'm sure you could rent out for the weekend for that kind of thing.
All, Although I did say that I don't entertain anymore. I don't entertain at home. I do entertain. I have done the odd pop-up or something like that. And in fact, I suggested to my publicity guy at Trans World, who I love my publishers. I've been so lucky with my agent and publishers that I just get on with them so well. I said to him, why don't we offer as a competition prize that I'll go to someone's home and cook the meal from Knife Skills for Beginners for someone in their home? And he said, you must be mad. I said, well, I'm sure I'd live to regret it. I hope the winner was somewhere local. But anyway, he said, we'll save that in case we need it. But so I'm not doing that.
I think the challenge of that, because we did do that occasionally at Great British Chefs, is you do realise that the poor chef who is used to cooking in a Michelin star kitchen rocks up at some house which barely has a microwave and certainly hasn't sharpened the knives. And I think has what can only be described as a cultural shock.
And you can't find anything when you cook. You can't find anything in the cupboards and you can't get the gas to work. It's the cookers and the ovens are so peculiar.
Yeah, these are the problems. Well, listen, I very much look forward to reading this, and I will obviously, you know, try and cook some of the recipes within it. But look, it's been fantastic talking to you. Thank you for coming on.
Thank you, Ollie, for having me. Great treat.
I look forward to reading the sequel as well.
Thank you very much. More recipes in that.
Excellent. Brilliant. Thanks very much, Orlando.
Thanks for listening to The Food Talk Show. And if you enjoyed this episode, please do follow us on LinkedIn or subscribe to us wherever you listen to your podcasts.